Hello and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading lists at mangasplaining.com. Now this week, we are continuing our Let's Give Chip Lots of Classic Manga to deal with. A trend. And so we're going back to our friend Manly Manga. Although this is more boyly manga, really. It is Kamen Rider by Shotaro Ishinomori. Seven Seas Entertainment has published a doorstop-sized 50th anniversary edition that is a hardcover. It is 800-something pages of Rider kicks and Rider jumps and whatever heck Kamen Rider wants to, I don't know, kick butt at. And it is quite the book. Let's start out how you normally do with a little description of what Kamen Rider is. So Kamen Rider, the 50th anniversary edition, just came out in January. It was translated by Kumar Siva Subramanian. It is lettered by the inimitable Phil Christie and edited by J.P. Sullivan. It was really published in 1971 to 1972, and it was published about the same time as the Kamen Rider TV series, a tokusatsu series, which is like live-action superhero series that aired on Japanese TV. Now, you might ask yourself, why did Debra pick Kamen Rider? Well, Kamen Rider and I go way back. That aforementioned TV show aired on Hawaii television, a Hawaii Japanese language TV station called Kiku TV. And I was at elementary school at the time, and Kamen Rider, Kikaider, all these tokusatsu shows were big hits in Hawaii. I remember going to school and, you know, we would get the toys. I still have some Kamen Rider toys from that time. We all wanted Rider belt. We did the henshin moves. We did the, you know, people would jump off the stairs trying to do the Rider kicks and stuff like that. It was a big deal. So that's my enduring love for Kamen Rider, despite having never read the manga until very recently. It's kind of like this fuzzy memory of this exciting TV show I saw when I was a kid. You know, things that you see when you're a kid are pretty special. And when you look at them as when you're adults, maybe not as special, but still touches your heart. So with that in mind, here's the description from Seven Seas. The original run of the legendary Kamen Rider manga, now in English as a special 50th anniversary hardcover omnibus. Fans the world over have been enthralled by the tales of Kamen Rider, the masked motorcycle riding superhero who protects the world from injustice. Kidnapped and experimented upon by the evil terrorist of their organization known as Shocker, Hongo Takeshi manages to escape their clutches and use his newfound strength to fight against their schemes. These are the first adventures in a legacy that spans dozens of television series and films written and drawn by the series creator and manga superstar creator, Shotaro Ishinomori. We also have a shared history of Kamen Rider in that I basically dragged all of you to Ishinomaki to visit two Shotaro Ishinomori museums. One is the Mangatan, which is the museum dedicated to the characters that he created. And the other one is his Furusato Museum in Otome, which is about his in his hometown and about him as a person. Yes. We went in November 2019.
We should specify that these are in Japan.
I think before we could not go back to Japan anymore, as we are not.
Before we were banned from the country for several years.
Damn it! So I wanted to ask you guys, well, I don't know who wants to start, but what were your experiences and impressions of Kamen Rider before we read this book?
I kind of want Chris to go first.
So I was a manga retailer, comics retailer for a really long time. And I think I'm remembering this correctly. It's a long time ago. I remember Tokyo Pop was like, we've got a new manga and it's super cool. It's called Skull Man and we're going to release it. And it's the inspiration for the hit Kamen Rider TV show. And it was like, what's a Kamen Rider? I have no idea what that is. They hadn't released the Kamen Rider manga to the best of my knowledge. And they were releasing something that was the inspiration for something like that meant something. And it didn't mean anything. And it was about a motorcycle riding Japanese superhero whose helmet was fashioned like a skull. It's awesome. It's available. There's previews of it up on Comixology and a couple other places on the internet. But yeah, I actually checked it out. I was like, 70s manga is great. Like, it's wild. And then they ended up, Tokyo Pop ended up doing Cyborg 009, which I've got a couple copies of on my shelf still, and a couple of other, I think, small things. Yeah, I was just like, wow, this has just such incredible energy. And that, along with some of the Viz reprints of some of Galaxy Express 999.
Leiji Matsumoto.
Yeah, the Leiji Matsumoto and a couple of other. I actually would go to Japanese bookstores that were in and around Toronto, and I would just grab random volumes of manga that looked good. I didn't read any Japanese at all, but I would get just the craziest, most like, and it was all like bins of stuff that had been like, we can't sell this in Japan anymore. Let's load this onto a container and just get it out of the country and stuff. So I've got like a three volume golf manga where like the villain of the first volume is maybe Jack Nicklaus, like a
nice,
thinly disguised Jack Nicklaus, like parody character. I've got just like all the crazy stuff from like the sort of the trash stuff, not the like mainstream stuff that didn't get sold in secondhand stores in Japan. Really neat stuff. So I had like a lot of old manga for a really long time. And when I thought this, I was like, oh, finally, something in English that I can read. And the energy still comes off the page. You know what I mean? With Skullman, it was Cyborg 009, especially. We went to the Ishinomaki Museum. Actually, I had been a couple of years prior because you had told me about your experiences of going. And then other friends, I'd just been doing all the comics museums in Japan because that's a thing I do. I've been to the Tezuka Museum like four times. And I'd gone to the Fujiko F. Fujio Doraemon Museum, which you have to take a bus to get to. It's in the suburbs somewhere. And obviously the Ghibli Museum and a couple of other like manga important places. And it was like, oh, you've never been to the Mangaton? And I'm like, what does that even mean? So I didn't know anything about it. And so I went there and I was like, oh man, this guy's a guy. Like, this is like a real, this guy's real. This guy's for real. Like, he's got a whole museum dedicated to him. It's shaped like a giant
spaceship.
Like a giant spaceship. You know, like I can't, it's shaped like a giant spaceship. And it was one of those moments getting there. And especially I actually went because it was after the 311 earthquakes. And I was like, I've got to get up into Tohoku now that things are reopening. And I'm not just going to be some white guy bumbling through while everyone's trying to like rebuild their lives. It's like, no, please visit Tohoku, spend money. It's like, done. I'm on board. So I did that. And, you know, it was a really eye-opening trip in a lot of ways. Like, you, like, suddenly you're like, oh, this guy, like, people talk about him, but like, he's the real deal. He's created all this stuff. So little of it is known in North America, except by super hardcore fans. And also, this town where he grew up and where he was born and stuff is trying to rebuild. And this, like it was just like it was a heavy experience. So going back with you guys, actually, in 2019 was nice because it was like, oh, they firmly rebuilt. Some things are like in a better place now. And it was more of a like fun trip as opposed to like a, like I sat in front of the train station waiting for my train, like having a cold drink and like really trying to process stuff the first time I went. The second time, I was actually just laughing because David was so cold. I was just like, stop. I felt so bad.
It was incredible.
We did go in November, late November.
It was really cold up north
prepared,
in Japan.
But I left all my thermals in Tokyo and when we went to Hokkaido.
Oh, that's why you were cold.
Yeah,
oh.
I really played myself.
Okay.
So yeah, there's really fun pictures that we haven't put online of us like doing like rider poses in front of Kamen Rider statues and like all kinds of stuff. And some of the other, actually we've put some into the show notes, but yeah, for me it was like, oh, this guy's a really like really important dude. But I had never read a manga. I'd never read any of his manga that cemented that. You know what I mean? It was just like the stuff we were getting was like, I had a lot of energy and it was really interesting, but like there's no Phoenix. You know what I mean? There's no Buddha. There's no really big work that I've read that's like, this is why this guy is this guy. And it's just down to what gets licensed and what doesn't get licensed in North America. I like Cyborg 009 a lot. I liked this, all spoilers. I actually really liked Kamen Rider a lot, but I wasn't aware of why he was so important until I started like really digging through on that last trip and buying a bunch of books I couldn't read again. And, you know, slowly making my way through them over the last couple of years. And it's like, oh yeah, this guy's for real. So I didn't really know much about Kamen Rider. I never watched the TV show. Didn't really know Ishinomori Sensei at all. Now my eyes are pretty open and I'm really excited and to find out more, especially having read this.
Nice. If you want to watch more of the show, the Tubi app has at least the first season.
And I think they have a YouTube channel now.
I actually just watched I sent you guys an email. I don't know if you got it, but I was like, I just watched the first episode of Kamen Rider. You guys have 25 minutes before the podcast starts. Totally watch it. I really want to talk about it with you guys later because it's like, wow, comics, so good. Anyway,
yeah,
I don't know. That was my experience with it. I get the sense that this kind of material, like, David, I know you're a huge fan of Cyborg 009, right?
Yeah.
Were you as into Kamen Rider as well? Like, were you as aware of it?
I was aware of it, but 009 was my, like, proper introduction to Ishinomori and kind of what made me love his work. And, like, the short version of that is that if Kamen Rider was kidnapped by an evil organization and given superpowers and uses those powers to fight against the organization, 009 is that, but, like, there's nine characters and they're all nine different kinds of cyborgs. It's very direct. But it's similar, you know, like, it talks about the ecosystem and things like that. But I knew about Kamen Rider because I was, like, 9 years old when Power Rangers came out. Mm-hmm. And maybe, like, late preteens, early teens when I finally saw the Guyver. So I was prepped for this kind of, like, rubber suit shenanigans. But it was very hard to come by. Like, I don't think I ever saw an episode of Kamen Rider when I was a kid. It was one of those, like, you know, mythical things. Like, someone who was stationed overseas saw Kamen Rider and it was this, this, and this. And I don't even think I knew that it was an ongoing series with several variations. You know, like, I think 28 was, like, the last number I saw or something like that. But, like, there's something very pure about this take on Japanese superheroes where, like, I think the American stuff I grew up on was very kind of commenting on and intentionally maturing, like, the superheroes that came before it. Like, Chris Claremont and X-Men is, like, a great example because there's, like, no civil rights metaphor in the Stan Lee and Jack Kirby stuff. And that's, like, a core part of the X-Men, you know, when you talk to people about it. But this is just like, what if a superhero is just a superhero and he murdered his bad guys and it was fine? You know, very direct.
Yeah, he had no, like, moral dilemma about it.
Yeah, like, the one time he does, he's like, oh man, that guy was innocent. Anyway, you know?
Yeah, like, at the beginning, like, he's just surprised when he, like, karate chops a guy and his head almost comes off.
He's like, oh wait, I'm strong. You know? And, you know, American superheroes, it's very much like, don't kill, you'll be as bad as the bad guys, yada, yada, yada. And, like, there's a point to that. But, like, the moral lesson here is almost be angry about injustice more so than, like, follow these prescribed rules. And that's kind of cool. But I think what makes Kamen Rider the coolest is that everything he does is easily imitatable on the playground.
It's true. I can vouch for that.
Like, I think that really goes a long way. Like, when Power Rangers came out, when Ninja Turtles was really going, like, there were ninjas, you know, in Power Rangers at every recess. Infuriating teachers. Apparently they hated it. Yeah. There's an insurance thing.
I have to interject here. Like, okay, it got so bad in Hawaii that they had the actual stars of these shows record a disclaimer. They recorded a thing where it says, "Hi, I'm Kamen Rider. Please don't do this at home because you'll get hurt." I don't know the exact wording, but I remember that the Japanese TV station here made them record that.
Wow. And that is a beautiful thing. Like, that is what kids need, I feel.
Yeah.
A healthy childhood. And this carries a lot of that same energy. It's barely written. Like, it was clearly written chapter to chapter, sometimes page to page. But there are so many different, like, cool moments or drawings, or the way he leans on, like, the slow-mo multiple pictures effect.
Which at first I thought
was, like, photostat, but, like, the drawings are different.
Yeah, they're true. Yeah. I know. I did the same thing. I'm just like, like, they're so, so similar. He doesn't change them much at all, but he's, like, he's still redrawing it.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
So,
Lightbox. Right?
Like, I would say that these are basic comics, but they're really fun. Like, they're uncomplicated. Like, you read them, it's a superhero, things happen, he saves the day. Yep. And then if you keep reading, I'm not sure if we all read past the 200-page mark that Deb mentioned.
Deb did.
I did.
I did.
So, like, the main character, spoilers, just dies 200 pages in.
Yeah.
Or, like, 250 pages in or something like that. And they replace him with a villain they just introduced. And it's such, like, it feels like fearless storytelling, but it happens because the actor in the TV show got hurt. And they wrote
that's right.
Seriously?
Yes, he broke his legs.
Oh my
halfway God. Through the series. And so they have to replace him. And then he comes back.
Yeah. So it's just a mess. And to think that this spawned such, like, I think franchise is too small of a, it's like a category of entertainment at this point. Like, tokusatsu rubber suit stuff. Like, it's really cool to see that. And also for the raw material to be so fun. despite being like clearly for like 8 year olds.
So this was, this is what basically created Power Rangers. Is that what you're saying? Like this was the first,
this created a parallel track to Power Rangers. One of his other series created Power Rangers.
Yeah. Okay. Of course.
He created a series called Himitsu Super Sentai Go Ranger, which means five Rangers. So that is also a storytelling archetype that has been continued.
Yeah.
Kikaido is another one. Cyborgs. Like, what I really love about Ishinomura is that he created what is basically a template that other people have built upon, both in Japan and internationally. But when you look at the template, it looks so simple.
Yeah.
It's hard to appreciate, but it influenced so much.
It's so funny because I've got no emotional connection to this kind of stuff at all because obviously I didn't watch television in Hawaii, so I didn't...
You're lost.
Yeah, I didn't see Kamen Rider there, and I was too old for Power Rangers when they were kind of a big thing, and same with Ninja Turtles. So, like, I have... There's nothing in my cultural wheelhouse except just my light mockery of the stuff because I was too old and too cool for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that made this an interesting read.
I mostly brought it to this group because I, you know, because Chip, you're a creator of superhero stories.
It's true.
And I thought it was, I've always kind of felt like Shotaro Ishinomori's work, he's basically like your Jack Kirby of Japan. Like he created a lot of the storytelling ideals and characters like and language. So on. That, you know, the language of superhero comics. But at the same time, I find it really fascinating that superhero comics are just not a dominant force in Japanese comics as they are in America.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between Kirby and this creator, I think, is just that Kirby was constantly trying to come up with new things. Whereas in here, it's just like, oh, it's a man spider. Oh, now it's a man coyote. It's a man bat. I don't know. It's like,
yeah.
like after the first three or four pages, like, all right, we're set. Let's just do this.
It reminded me a little bit of the first couple of years of Amazing Spider-Man, where it's like Spider-Man would have a different animal-themed villain to fight every week. And like occasionally you'd get a Mysterio, but it's like Lizard, Chameleon, Razorback, official mascot of the...
Is he in the first year of Spider-Man?
He is not in the first year of Spider-Man. Nice try.
No, I know. I'm just giving shit.
It's revisionist history.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe this is Spider-Man Chapter 1, Christopher.
Yeah.
But they did get into, like, they have, like, the Medusa character show up, for example.
Yeah.
And they do have, like, I'm worried. I really liked this.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really liked it. And I'm worried that it's, like, normally I'd be the one to try and have some of that same ironic distance or that, like, I'm better than this that Chip's talking about with kids' properties. But, like, man, there's a sequence. And I don't have page numbers. I read this physically and I didn't screen cap it like I usually would. Mm-hmm. I was reading digitally, but there's a sequence where he stabs the Batman. Sorry, Man Bat.
Man
sorry.
Bat.
Both are trademarked. It's
bat. Yeah, I was going to say.
Bat powered shocker bad guy. Yep. Stabs him through the wings, right?
Yeah.
And like with this like spear that the guy can't reach to get out of his own wings, which is actually kind of funny. And so he's got to like run away at like top speed. So he gets on his bike and goes after him. And it, from him getting on the bike to when he catches up to him, it's like 9 pages of him riding the bike and looking badass. Like 2-panel page, full page spread, double page splash, splash page, 2-panel page, double page splash. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Like you're reading these comics and it's so visceral and immediate and like awesome. And then it was just like, oh my God, this guy's a legend. Like this guy's a legend. Yeah. Where has this been? Like why? I would have loved if so, all of a sudden, you know, hopefully it wasn't Danzig publishing it because who knows, but like I'm reading superheroes. I'm super into superheroes. I'm loving them. And all of a sudden it's like, all right, here you go. Here's Kamen Rider. And it's got like 9 consecutive, nearly splash pages or better. And you're just like, this is insane. Like imagine some kid reading this. And then 50 pages later, imagine some kid watching him get shot to death. Like actually dying and getting replaced by a different dude. And then his brain lives on in a jar and communicates with the new Kamen Rider using like radio telepathy or something. Sure. I don't know. They kind of hand wave a lot of the special stuff
that worked
like
for Batman Beyond.
The science fiction.
Yeah.
But it's just like, man, this comic honestly just kicks ass. Like it, and literally like kicks. I mean, it mostly kicks arms off of the bad guys, but it's so good. Like I loved it. And I read the whole thing in a sitting and I couldn't stop. I had to go to the bathroom. I just kept reading. It was awful. I was like, great. But it was anyway. So yeah, so that's, I guess we didn't get to takes, but man, like there's no ironic distance for this. I'm not saying this in like how, I don't know. I kind of just wrote the Devilman show notes yesterday. And I was like remembering my reaction to Devilman as reading. I was like, holy shit, I can't believe they get away with that. But I actually lost myself in Kamen Rider versus having that distance in Devilman.
Yeah.
Like I was shocked when they shot him, like actually shocked, not like, oh, I see what they're trying to do from a storytelling perspective here. And I was not expecting that. I was expecting to like on Origin, like Devilman, not like Nausicaa, cause I'm just a weeb, but like a lot of the classic manga we've been reading, I expected to have that distance of time and irony. And we're all much more mature and we're telling different kinds of stories now. And instead it's just like, so direct and like hits a point in my brain that I think I've always wanted in comics.
I was just going to say, like, you're talking about that chase sequence, just reminded me of him dropping to the earth.
Oh, I have that flag too. Oh,
which is like
8 pages of that.
It's like 8 pages of that, like just like the coolest layouts and shots. And then just that the one page where it's just from his perspective of the city getting closer.
Yeah, yeah, the zoom in, which so, we can do now.
So beautiful,
with Google, but
yeah, but like, just I mean, like
1970, he did that.
This guy clearly enjoys drawing architecture too, because like any architecture shot is gorgeous here. But I love that it's just like this whole build up, and then he's just like he spins, and then he just like gently touches his foot to the ground, and he's fine.
Yeah, I love it. There's no trick. He just
there's no trick. He's just like, nope. I'm just gonna do a nice cool spin. And then that's that.
I mean, some of it feels like, you know, obviously, like we talked about in Devilman, this is a guy who's doing a weekly comic series on a deadline, trying to keep up with a TV series.
Yeah.
So he's doing a lot of double page spreads and he's best stretching shit just to make the page count.
But it works.
But at the same time, it's exciting to see, because I don't normally see this kind of decompressed storytelling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he's just like capturing the action and the motion, you know, like what you would see from a TV show. And maybe that's the immediacy of like, it also was adapted as a TV show almost simultaneously. So there's that different sense of visual storytelling that he does. But also I think Ishinomori is just a visual genius in a lot of ways. Like he's kind of like Tezuka. He was an assistant to Tezuka during Astro Boy. And he also was a mentor to Go Nagai, who was his assistant. When I've read about Ishinomori, he said he was just like a artistic prodigy as a kid, and that his curiosity and drive to create a different type of visual storytelling, like showing time and space and action in different ways, you can just see his brain just going, like trying to find all these different ways to express this. Mm-hmm. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's so good. And like, you know, you talk about the decompression. The fact that we followed Nausicaa with this.
Oh, God!
like retroactively, it makes Nausicaa just look like garbage.
No!
Yeah.
So mean.
It does.
So mean.
100%. Nausicaa is just like, ugh. Like, this is comics. This is fun, big. They're doing things with time and space and panels. Like, there was nothing being done in Nausicaa that was interesting in terms of, like, storytelling, I'd say.
And you're talking specifically about like the mechanics of comics storytelling.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
Nausicaa is like, literally, I've got ideas and I'm trying to get them onto the paper as quick as I can in as many small panels as
possible. And I only have 20 sheets of paper. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
The store's closed. I can't go get more paper. That's Nausicaa.
And I love that about Nausicaa, but I've actually felt like for the whole week, like, man, that Nausicaa episode we recorded sucked. That was terrible.
What?
Yeah. It was all me. It wasn't you guys. It was like, just like, oh man, I did not engage their criticisms. I just like was like, I love Nausicaa.
No, that's
like,
fine.
Yeah, I was
thinking about
it. It's like reading this is like it. This actually, this 800 page volume took me less time to read than the 150 page Nausicaa that we read last time. I was just paging through it so quick. But you're right, it's a different thing, man. Like, this is comics. Like, this is comics and not just superhero comics and not just manga, but like man, this dude loves telling stories on a printed page.
Yeah.
And Miyazaki, his work does not feel that. He comes alive in animation, for sure.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about people who make comics because they love drawing, people who make comics because they have a story they need to tell.
Yeah.
And I think by Miyazaki's own admission, Nausicaa was a comic he made because he needed to tell the story for Animage, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But even just reading this back-to-back, I had the same thought as Chip, because sometimes there's 8 panels a page, and like that's like a crowded page, but it still feels not that claustrophobic.
Yeah.
In this book. But there are so many shots that are like, oh, this is comics. Like, here's a good zoom, here's a good reaction shot. All the cityscapes, all the computer stuff, I'm a sucker for.
Yeah.
Oh my god, the computer is just so good in that, eh?
Yeah, like Leiji Matsumoto does that stuff too. It's like 71 was probably before Marvel started its like exploitation vibe. I guess Luke Cage was starting to come out, but like Paul Gulacy hadn't hit yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jim
yeah.
Starlin was on the way. Like, this is all part of like a continuum of comics getting weird for me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I think that actually one reason maybe why this hasn't taken off in the US is that it's not as sophisticated as the Marvel books of a similar era. So people who were looking for superhero comics were looking for like 14 plus. Well, this is still like 10 plus, you know?
Yeah.
But keep in mind too, like in this edition, and what I also want to point out too, that's different than, okay, so back up. Mm-hmm. Ishimori Pro, the management company, I guess, of Shotaro Ishimori's estate, published several of this series on Comixology as digital-only releases, like Skullman and Kikaider and Kamen Rider and so on. And so some people have asked me, what is the difference between this version that we're discussing today, the Seven Seas version, and that version? And one is that, besides the beautiful color pages in the front, which we'll probably get into later, there are some additional stories in the back that were originally published. There says Disneyland edition, and then there's a part that says published in a kindergarten book. So there are versions of Kamen Rider stories that were designed expressly for elementary school kids.
Wow. I love that. Mm-hmm.
Kamen Rider is actually considered to be, you know, Hideaki Anno notwithstanding.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on the new Shin Kamen Rider movie, but it's mostly designed for young kids, like 10 and younger, 12 and younger. I mean, Kamen Rider as a franchise sells millions of dollars per year in just pure merchandise and toys. There's a new Kamen Rider show almost every year. Tokusatsu is a formula where there's the hot guy, which serves two purposes. One is to excite the kids. Other is to excite the kids' moms.
That does explain Takeshi Hongo. Yeah. He's like still around, the original actor.
Oh yeah, they come to Hawaii and they do autograph sessions, you know.
His legs are fine.
I'm watching that, I'm like, this is a handsome man. This is a handsome man playing with Kamen Rider.
And so once they figured out this formula, they just ran with it and ran with it and ran with it. And props to you, Ishinomori Pro.
Yeah.
So I did a little bit of show notesy research before we started this one, because I felt like I got caught with my pants down a little bit on Devilman, and I was just like discovering things mid-podcast in Google. And so just like to get this out of the way, the Kamen Rider TV show started off as an adaptation of his previous comic, which was called Skullman, which he also was a one-volume book that he did in 1970. And they were like, oh, Skullman maybe isn't going to fly for kids on daytime television. And so they got Ishinomori to redesign the character. So Skullman is another like helmeted motorcycle riding bad guy fighting kind of a weird looking good guy fighting against a shadowy organization. So he filed off the edges. He like turned all the guys to have animal themes, that kind of thing. Kamen Rider, he's modeled after a grasshopper because that's like it's in a lot of Japanese folktales and traditions and things like that. And it's sort of like spiders, you know, in Spider-Man in North America, right? So his manga, this manga that we read actually, began simultaneously with the show. The show is like based on Skullman. He was involved with like putting together like story ideas and things like that. But the comics, the ones that we're reading, are his take on the same stories. So it's actually a lot closer to something like the Evangelion manga by Yoshiyuki Sadamoto that we've mentioned a couple times in the podcast, where it was like based on the same outline, but he's doing this in parallel. So he gets to tell his version of the story, and I like it better. it doesn't do some things as well, obviously. And that first episode of Kamen Rider is awesome. Like everyone is lit only across the eyes. Like, it's like, it's a spiritual successor to the Batman television show in a lot of ways, but like serious, like a serious version of that.
It's applying the Godzilla monster formula to Batman 66 a little bit.
Wow.
But much less corny, like very childlike earnest, you know?
And you would actually like, and it's real superheroes too. Like at a moment he like crushes something with his hand and breaks it. And he's like shot in profile, looking down and thinking, I'm not even a man anymore. Yeah. I'm a, like, what am I? I'll never be able to fit into society. Like, it's pure Marvel Comics. Yeah. Like, and you know, the fact that the first two villains in this book are Spider-Man and Man-Spider and Man-Bat is like a nice little wink and a nod to American superheroes, which I think this takes.
I mean, some inspiration the last from, villain in the book is Mandrilla. So I feel like that's very, very close to another Marvel villain.
What I thought was fascinating too is like you have to get to page 525 for there to be an actual comprehensive explanation of what Kamen Rider's powers actually are.
Oh yeah, he's completely making it up. Every time they mention something to do with the plot, it's the first time they mentioned anything to do with that aspect of the plot. Like the G project partway through, the way his motorcycle charges him up right before he gets killed. He's like, oh, I can't drive fast, so I can't get full power. And then he gets shot. It's sort of exhilarating.
I didn't even know the part about like in his belt, there's like a little fan there. Like if you're on 526, it says it's a wind gauge or an energy barometer. It's like, what? You mean all those times when he's riding on the motorcycle and talking about the wind, there's a meaning behind that?
I thought it was poetry.
Me too.
No, this makes it really explicit. He gets his powers from the wind somehow, which is fine.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. And I read this knowing that he was doing this the same time as the TV show is that like he'd tell a story and it would take like 100 pages, which is like 5 weeks. In that time, five episodes, Monster of the Week episodes have aired of the TV show. Mm. So every time he starts a new story, there's a ton of backstory that the kids who are also watching the TV show have that he has to incorporate in a flash. And so you get these things like a full page explanation of his suit or like with a cutaway or like a cutaway diagram of his helmet up close, which is like so awesome. I love that kind of diagrammatic shit when they put it into comics as a kid.
Yeah.
I love it now, obviously, but it's a whole other,
this is
like he's doing it at the same time and gets to, it's like, it really is a companion piece to the live action, but it also gives so much more depth to what's happening in the live action episode. Like even that first episode with the spider, it was 25 minutes and it's like over 100 pages in this book. You know what I mean?
That's so wild, the idea of these being kind of near simultaneous. Like, has anything like that happened in North American comics?
There's something happening right now.
Mark Miller with his Netflix stuff.
Oh, really?
Really?
Tell me more.
Because he has all these like kind of Netflix shows, but he's also, he's putting out comics like just before, during, like...
Oh,
I don't know.
Jupiter's Legacy had a sequel to the Netflix show, I think.
Yeah. Like he kind of announces them both at the same time now. Like, there's a TV show and a comic coming.
But then he's created the comic ahead of time. Kamen Rider feels more like flying without a net.
I don't think he's creating the comics ahead of time. Ultimately, like, because he works for Netflix now. Like, he makes TV shows and he also makes the comics still for a reason that I don't quite understand. But maybe this is the reason.
He gets to tell the story 100% his way, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't think Hollywood would allow that kind of like that little lead time between writing something and filming something. And
I bet if you just have the idea in like a strong pitch, like an outline for a story, they can run with the TV or movie version.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And you can fill in the blanks in the comic. But that actually reminds me of something that I appreciate about Ishinomori's work is that it's so like for 10-year-olds, as Deb was saying.
Yeah.
That when you make it mature, it's almost like a blank canvas to do any kind of story you want. Because there's a Skullman animation that came out over here like 2007 or something like that.
Wow.
But it's almost like X-Files in tone. Like very much investigating this creepy town where there's like murders happening. And it sort of escalates into a Kamen Rider-esque story where someone has to put on a mask to save the day. And it's not as good of a reinvention as something like Devilman Crybaby, but it's in that same kind of lane where it's like, this is one for people who grew up on this thing. Kind of want to see it a little bit more mature.
There's been 30 30 iterations of Kamen Rider as a TV show. And I was trying to figure out, like, what's the connecting thread between it. And it basically, the theme is about a guy who gets these superpowers that he got from the enemies he's fighting, where he's using the powers he gained from his enemies against them. Everything after that, besides the motorcycle and the mask and whatever else, is up to grabs. In fact, like, I think there's a current Kamen Rider Revice, which includes a female Kamen Rider who is a sister.
Nice.
A lady Kamen Rider.
Yeah. 50 years later, there's a lady Kamen Rider.
A friend was telling me that there are a couple Kamen Riders who are themed after Man Bat and Man Spider as a throwback to the first, like, series.
Is that right?
Oh, really? Cool.
But actually, the last fan sub series I watched was Kamen Rider Forza. I don't think I made it all the way to the end, but it was the 2011 Kamen Rider where the theme was spaceflight because it was the 50th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's flight. So it was like they had a base on the moon. It was all about friendship. It was very toyetic. That's the other sort of thing that doesn't come up in this volume that we read as much. But they all have special belts or like accessories that let them transform into Kamen Rider now. Instead of like changing clothes like some kind of human being.
It's kind of like Star Wars, right? In that I feel like Kamen Rider and Star Wars have one thing in common is that sometimes their plot is driven by toy manufacturing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Iron Man too. The way like his armor just kind of comes on now, like that's a Henshin thing, I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can sell like the models and the pull apart toys and things.
I don't know, Chip, like when you're reading this, you know, this is superheroes, a different approach, a different perspective on it, a different audience even. How does it make you feel? Or like, what do you take anything from it? Or does it make you go, what the hell?
Well, I guess all of the above. Yeah, like, I mean, I'm trying to relate it to early Marvel stuff. Mm-hmm. And the early Marvel stuff seems to have more going on than this. So I still gravitate more towards that. But yeah, we've already talked about like kind of just the layout and the pacing here, which is far superior to the Marvel stuff. Yeah, it's pretty wild. I find this a very strange book because like I can't recommend it to anyone. Like I can't recommend it to a 10-year-old because it's filled with murder.
The cultural mores have changed since 1971.
Yeah. Yes. I can't recommend it to an adult because it skews too young, but I can maybe recommend it to like adults who have seen it all. Right? Like
Chris.
Exactly. That understand comics and comic art and stuff, who would appreciate what this is going for. It's kind of like when you're a kid, you love like Archie comics, and then you don't like Archie comics, and then as an adult, you look at them and appreciate like how well done they are.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's how this kind of feels to me. Like I can be like, oh, this is really well done. I'm not taking anything emotionally from it. I'm not like, wow, this is the best comics. Like, oh, I'm really into it because I'm not 10. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Chris. But I appreciate it more than probably all the retro books we've been looking at recently. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Well, I'm trying to think like Nausicaa. No, get out of here. Devilman. Like Devilman comes close. Like there's a lot of fun stuff in there, but it's too poorly done in a lot of ways to kind of reach this level.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we done?
I think we did Gundam the Origin.
It.
Gundam the Origins, like there are parts of that I like, but I just found a lot of the drawings too confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very simple yet detailed, evocative. Like there's a very strong understanding of how a page should look and where to bring the eye that some of the previous books don't have. So I very much appreciate it on a technical level. I don't know what is up with manga from the 70s, but they cannot draw the human body. And it's blowing my mind.
I was going to point out a spread for that. Page 242 is like the best drawing of a dirt bike and the worst drawing of a body.
Let's see, 242.
Let's see this.
See this.
Oh.
Like the brushy wheels, like the great.
Oh, it's super cool. Bike.
and then look at his foot, and it's like, oh. Wait, how big is this guy?
Oh, it doesn't, yeah. And any shot of him just without his shirt on or whatever, like, the muscles make no sense. It's like, they're like Stretch Armstrong figures, where there's no actual muscle definition. You just kind of bend it in whatever direction.
Yeah. Just wait till we get to Boys Love.
Okay, good.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because there was a thing in this that made me like reconsider my appreciation of the art. It was something he said, and it was like the sort of big green dots on Kamen Rider's costume are supposed to be analogous to his pectoral muscles. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no one on Earth's pectoral muscles are shaped that way. Like, literally no one. And the fact is, those two big dots, and then when you see him with his shirt off on 285, it's like, oh my God, like, this dude does not know what muscular dudes look like with their shirts off. Like, he just doesn't. And we have our own, in North American comics, our own weird, crappy deformations of the human body in superhero comics, sure, especially, that sort of go in a different direction than this.
Yeah.
But like, it's still wrong.
Yeah.
But the thing that is really exciting to me about this art is, you look at that shot of his body on 285, and it's just like, it's a transitional kind of illustration, especially the illustration on the previous page. He's moving from this sort of rubberized limb, deeply animation influenced illustration that Tezuka came up with that defined all of manga. All of manga looked like Tezuka, give or take, whatever Tezuka was doing at the time. And he is like transitioning away, where it's like, all of a sudden, he's got a character who's a heroic character who's more than 5 heads tall. He's 9 heads tall, and it's not proportioned correctly, but it's really different. And he's got these, there's still some rubberized, like, animation-influenced illustrations here, but on top of it, he's layering on so much realistic hatching. Like, that Kamen Rider mask is always glinting. Like, there's so much tiny hatching. There's no, like, there's very little tone used at all. It's only used as, like, flat blocks. And it's all like, especially the really beautiful, like, full page spread stuff. It's just like, it's these rubberized, not quite right human forms with intense detail layered on top of them.
Yeah.
And it creates something that's unlike anything I've seen in comics. It seems like a transitional work. And I know his work used to look almost identical to Tezuka. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he came out of that school for sure. And I know his later stuff was a lot different and caricature-y, but, you know, people want the hits, and it's like, this is what it looks like maybe when you age up, you make mature a popular series by like layering like detail and stuff like that onto it. But at the end of the day, it's still superhero comics. You know what I mean? Like, it's still kids' adventure stuff. But whatever's going on here, like, it hits the funny bone in the right way from, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, not the funny bone, but the, like, it's like, I feel like it's like when nerds see Alex Ross paintings that recreate their favorite superhero covers from like the 1940s, like when Alex Ross goes all in on like a Justice Society thing, and it's gonna take this frankly ridiculous thing, and if you look at it, it's like all of these people that are realistic painted on this cover in these costumes would look not even like circus performers, but like completely like crazy people in the real world who I have painted. But because it's an homage, and because it's using this like existing idea, people who that's for, it's what they've always wanted. They've always wanted their superhero comics to look exactly like Alex Ross is painting them when he does, especially when he does like a recreation. And I kind of feel like this is like the mature shonen action hero before someone gets on the scene that, David, this is just for you.
Yeah.
It's the difference between the muscular dudes that Buronson draws in Fist of the North Star and the muscular dudes that get drawn into JoJo's by Araki Sensei. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, they both come out of the same place in the early JoJo stuff. Like, they were ran in the magazine at the same time, but all of a sudden, like a switch flips, and like JoJo's turns into like how people, like a more realistic kind of drawing coming out of this, like deeply influenced by Fist of the North Star space. Mm-hmm. And this is like the transitional work between drawing cartoon kids comics, like kids cartoony comics, and drawing something that looks like a real live action superhero show, which is what is airing at the same time. It is a fascinating work for that. Like, the show notes are gonna be so long. There's panels and panels and panels where it's like, look at how he draws this hand, and it's just like four rubberized lines. And then look at the leather jacket that he's wearing, that it's the hand is attached to, And he probably spent an hour cross-hatching the shit out of that jacket. There's no solid blacks. Mm. It's all hatches to create a shimmering, rippling effect. It's just, it's amazing to me. Like, just as like a piece of craft, I'd kill to see the original art for this. I've never seen, even in the museum, there's like 7 or 8 Ishinomori comics pages, but nothing from this, nothing that looked like this. It was all sort of cartoony and Tezuka-like.
If you look at the spreads on page 502 and 503, and then the following spread on 504 and 505, you can kind of see that mix of styles you're talking about, where like a blushing character is just kind of a round face with lines drawn across it. You know, kissing people, very direct, huge eyes. And then on the next page, there's like a super realistic lady drawn, you know, in a waterfall and super realistic boats. And all of this has to exist in kind of the same realm, like the cave. The rocks are very realistic compared to the characters.
Yeah.
Did you see the, I love his, how he uses blacks and whites in really dramatic ways. Like in 63, 64, 65, 66, like the one where the spider is like, on all his hands out and he spews like the webs on him.
Yeah.
It's really so gorgeous. Then it's also like, gross. Then he jumps up, you know, like when he rider jump and he like escapes the webs. I mean, these are not the usual visual solutions for these sequences.
Yeah.
And I respect that intensely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what I'm talking about. So that double page spread is honestly gorgeous. I'm going to put it in the show notes for sure. And it's like, if you just look at it, if you read it at the speed that you read comics, the spider is actually drawn. He's a grotesquerie. He's like a spider man. He's like a spider character. So he's supposed to look kind of awkward and weird, which is great. And then when he's like got the webs on him, just like scroll down to the bottom of that page. And it's like, his butt is basically a sphere. Like the dude didn't draw a human butt on Kamen Rider.
Yeah.
He drew a like animation Tezuka, like whoop, like circle. But he's got this otherwise like beautifully detailed, realistic, like these wispy spider webs. And it's just like, it's crazy to me that like he doesn't, it's a little bit like we talked about storytelling in Phoenix when Chip read the wrong book. And he was like, he's just like, he's going along and he's telling a story. And all of a sudden there's like a musical interlude where all the wolves that are about to eat them do like a song and dance number. And it's like Tezuka has not figured out how to incorporate serious themes into the kinds of comics he knows how to make, right? This is the same thing, but on an artistic, like on just talking about the art, I feel is like he's got all these advanced techniques and these rendering styles and these things that he's trying to do, but it's still on top of these bodies that he's been drawing for his whole life, right? Like he's been drawing this way at this point in 71 for 16 years, maybe after the war, 15 years. He's a child prodigy. It could even be longer. And it's like, that's what a butt looks like from behind. It's just a sphere with legs coming out of it. And you're like, no, that's not what a butt looks like. But also, oh my God, that spider you drew on the same page, the Spider-Man, is beautiful.
See, I took that page to be the spider webs is so terrifying that he's just filling his diaper.
You know, that's a good interpretation. You know what? This takes away or gives more credit to Ishinomori. Yeah. I can't tell.
But weirdly appropriate segue, maybe. But I kept thinking of reading Raw Hero for the podcast while reading this.
Oh, yeah? Tell me why. Yeah.
Because Raw Hero is kind of, it grew out of the ground that was fertilized by this book. Like a lot of the tropes, a lot of the costumes, the animal characters having weird like accents, you know?
Yeah.
But it's Raw Hero is just on the other end of the maturity spectrum, but at the same level of like juvenilia, I feel.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And so much of this, the storytelling, I think his limitation is I can only draw what can be actually reproduced in a TV show of a limited budget. There's no CGI. This is 1970s, by the way. And, you know, it's not a fancy motorcycle. It's a standard motorcycle. And it's, you know, it's, I sometimes think, you know, like sometimes people create comics or visual stories because anything's possible in comics, right? Whatever you can draw, it can be. But in this case, I feel like he had, like, whether he was super conscious of it or not, his limitations on the storytelling is what can be accomplished in the real world as a tokusatsu show. Yeah.
And even then, they don't quite make it. I like this so much that I was like, oh no, I don't trust my opinion anymore. So.
I don't know. I love it too.
No, I showed Andrew the first episode, and we sat and watched it together, and he's like, "That was amazing." And I'm like, "The manga's better." He's like, "I don't see how that's possible in 1971." And I showed it to him, and I showed him all the stuff we've been talking about, the staccato. He used a good word because he's smarter than me, but he the staccato rhythm of the moment to moment panels that are used, when he's getting on the bike and stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Oh my God, it is better." It's exactly that sort of and I was like, "And in the comic, the Spider-Man has four arms, but in the show, he only has two because they didn't have the budget to make two more prosthetic arms." And he's like, "That's not important. It looked really good in the show, but this looks better in different ways." And it's
that makes no sense in the show. How can he be a Spider-Man if he doesn't have extra arms?
He's only got six arms in this. He should have eight appendages.
Oh,
it's a spider. He's not a bee, although that comes later, apparently, in a show only. Yeah, I was so blown away by the art in this. I was like, and it towards the end, actually, and this is something and David, you read to the end too, right?
I read 500 pages. I was almost to the end.
Oh no, you weren't. You were 300 pages from the end.
That's an 800 to the beginning. I was more to the end than I was to the beginning.
So there's a double page spread. So of course there's an evil horse. There's real evil horses. I want to talk about the dog too. There's an evil dog at a certain point with the Medusa character.
Yeah, yeah.
That again looks like it's drawn.
It's a Tezuka.
Right of 1950s. Yeah, Tezuka animation. And then the horses also look like they're from a different book than the rest of the characters, but in a really fun cartoony way rather than looking too realistic like a lot of the backgrounds sometimes do.
The centaurs, so
there's angry
there
horses on page 716.
Yeah, that's a very Tezuka horse. It looks drawn differently, doesn't it?
Oh yeah It's great.
And then even when you flip forward and that there's a page where the bikes are getting away from the horses on 720 a couple pages later, and the horses in that panel are drawn slightly less cartoony and more realistic because the bikes are so realistic looking. They wouldn't fit in the same world anymore. I think there's something there where you're you're in a shonen manga magazine in 1970. Kodansha published it. I can't remember which one it was. It was Shonen Action or something like that. And it's there's a house style. There's a way that you have to draw at that point to be a successful kids comic. And I feel this feels like he's butting up against it. And it feels like the TV show is pulling it in a more realistic direction because he gets to see his ideas, his story ideas and his characters and things like that, and what they would actually look like in the real world. And it pulls his really cartoony work into a more realistic place. And it's just so neat. Such a neat artifact.
Well, on 660, right? 660, there's this drawing of Kamen Rider jumping, and it looks like it's just an ink drawing of a photo from the TV show.
Yeah, 660 is crazy.
That's wild.
Too. There's a character in one of the short stories where the character has a nose kind of looks like a block of tofu. And it's very much like a Tezuka character.
Look at 660 again and then go to 661. It goes from that super detail to probably one of the most cartoony looking pages I've seen in this.
Yes.
Yeah, this story and onwards from the end of the book look like what I expect Shotaro Ishinomori manga to look like.
Yeah.
They actually look like cartoony, rubbery, et cetera, kind of illustration, which I love, no shade. But the fact is that he as an artist is clearly trying to stretch, himself, which is really on the page. I can say the print tip, by the way, are you guys using digital or are you guys looking at the print? I know Deb and I have the physical book.
Digital.
Okay, well, the physical book is a monster.
Jesus.
Yeah, and also really expensive. It's at least 41 Canadian.
Oh yeah, it's $32.99 US, $40.99 in Canadian. Yeah.
On everything except for the backup material, I actually think I buy the digital version as well, so it's easier to make show notes because I can just screen grab stuff. But everything except for the bonus material, the Disneyland comic and stuff, is beautifully reproduced too. This is actually, I think it looks better on the printed page as manga than it does in digital. And I don't usually care, honestly. I like reading physical books, don't get me wrong. But I think that there's something about the way that the ink lays on the page. It just gives it sort of a life and a body. But I've talked a lot about things that I like. So I hope that whoever is still listening to the podcast after I shat all over parts of Devilman last week from Seven Seas is favorable. But yeah, the reproduction in a lot of the bonus material is like a little dark and too muddy. Mm. If you go to 819 in particular, yeah. I haven't compared it to the digital yet, but like it's pretty muddy. This beautiful man spider of Shocker story that's like a third retelling of that story. So I don't love that. And also, there's literally nothing that explains what the Disneyland manga is or what the kindergarten manga is. Just like Devilman, there's no essay. There's not even like an editor's note or anything like that. And I know that Chip got on my ass in the Devilman episode for this, but like, if you're doing an archival project, you need to treat it like an archival project. Like, you need to have some standards about explaining this material and where it came from. And I don't know.
Who gives a shit?
I do.
I am so glad that this hardcover version has the color intro pages because they are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like the
I don't know. Are they?
Chip?
Are they gorgeous, Chip?
I love them.
I mean, you know what? Like, they are. They're very detailed.
the scene where he's getting shocked with the red. Like, when you compare that to the black and white version of that same page, it's so much more beautiful as a color page.
Oh God, yeah.
And then the intro, like how he intros, like, you know, Takeshi Hongo is on the examining table and how he's. The colors, the swirl of circles. I think that's a really inventive way of showing like this guy is on an operating table and hallucinating a little bit. I mean, these are clearly pages he cared and spent a lot of time on and didn't have as much time and care to spend on some of the other pages.
Yeah.
But I do love it.
It's one of those things like you can tell there's definitely a lot of care put into the color on these pages. But just again, the decision making is what I have issue with. Like, well, I'm looking at page 7 right now, and it's like Kamen Rider, pre-Kamen Rider, whatever, on his bike, looking behind him at the car. His outfit is blue. The background is the same color of blue, and the car is being colored with that blue. Mm. Like, nothing, it doesn't help anything, these choices.
It's like a wicked tangent with his glove as well.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they're not afraid to do emotional coloring either, because when the car actually hits the bike and he goes flying, the backgrounds turn like red and yellow and like speed lines, and there's some great emotional coloring there, and the whole sequence could have been colored that way, and maybe just do like a realistic thing, like view when it's just from what's-his-name's point of view, like the old dude.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, the operating table stuff and the fact that like the emotional coloring on him when he gets shocked and it's all red, or the next page when his like body is in that like deep orange red against the black background. So good. I actually really like it.
Yeah, there's some fun stuff in there. But again, it's like, yeah, there's limitations in terms of color theory.
Mm. And his black and white is honestly so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, as soon as I switch to black and white, I'm like, oh, I love this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I posted on Twitter a comparison of that color page where he's getting the electric shock with the red. And compared it with the version that the Ishimori Pro previously published. And you can see the difference in the lettering and the difference in choices in the translation. Mm. And I appreciate it. It's a really nice apples and apples comparison. I think it's this nice mix of giving you the English translation of what the words are, but also keeping the energy of the original Japanese lettering, sound effect lettering. And that's not easy to do. Like, even the words within the robot talking to him is a different font and a more mechanical-looking font. And these are small changes that I think enhance the storytelling.
They do some fun things with lettering in this book. There's a story almost at the end of the book where he comes in sort of diagonally into a panel, like crashes through a window or a wall or something, and all of his word balloons are actually tilted, maybe from the original Japanese. And so they tilted the dialogue that was in them as well.
Wow.
It was like, oh, that's actually like a fun little thing that they carried over. Like, they actually paid attention to and carried over from the Japanese. I'll throw it in the show notes. But yeah, the lettering is like, you know, fine. I think they made some really good choices, but the fact that they're willing to do fun little things like that, and how much that they've, whenever possible, replaced sound effects, but they've also left in sound effects when they're like really beautifully drawn, which I think is like, that hybrid approach, knowing how much to change and not change, is actually really difficult. Props to the letterer and editor for having foresight to do that, because it was gorgeous all the way throughout, I thought.
Yeah, but it's always fun to play with the form like that. There's even a panel early on where someone gets scared and jumps and his hand hits the top of the panel. And there's only a few panels that are like explicitly like fourth wall breaking where in a comic book.
Yeah.
You know, most are more traditional than that. But it's such like a cute and like kind of Tezuka-ish thing, it feels like. But there's so much in here that like Ishinomori forgets about over the course of the series. Like 100 pages in, there's this random bug lady that you never see again.
Yeah.
Reporting to the boss, you know, and then it like goes to the Man-Bat story. You're like, okay, well, that's that, I guess.
Or like when Moray Eelman saves Bugman or Spider-Man.
Yeah.
The beginning of that chapter, Moray Eelman is never seen again. And they even go to an underwater bad guy's lair and he's not there.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're just inventing characters and then like moving on. Which is, I think, if anything, strengthens the Kirby stuff, or maybe strengthens the Claremont comparisons you were kind of hinting at as well. It's like, I'm going to introduce a bunch of stuff that's going to add texture and not actually mean anything.
I mean, it's this whole thing where his scars show up when he's losing control or angry, like Orion from the New Gods.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I think my favorite thing in this book, hands down, is the resolution of the Cobra Man story. Oh. Actually, the climax and the resolution, where first they reveal that he was turned into Cobra Man, but was already dating Snake Lady Medusa. Which is a whole thing. I've got several questions there. But the end of that story, where like Medusa's going wild and shooting and accidentally kills him, and then kills herself, and then Kamen Rider's looking at it all happen, and it's just like dot, 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 ellipsis. Ludicrous ending for a child's book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she's such a great designer.
Like, I thought sunglasses. She was just crying over his body. I got to reread that.
Yeah. No, she blew the back of her head off. It's crazy.
Yeah, like at 337, like she basically aims guns at her own head.
And the guns are shaped like snakes because this is for children.
Yeah, of course.
Because she, you know, killed her lover. Like she thought she killed Kamen Rider, but no.
Kind of like in Devilman, right? Where the villain women are more interesting than the actual love interest woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like the second, third woman in the book, maybe, and the first with a personality.
Yeah.
Yeah. 300 pages in.
And her personality is suicide.
Right? Though I forgot to mention earlier, speaking of Devilman and Ishinomori, there's a Cyborg 009 and Devilman crossover animation series. I think it's 2 or 3 episodes long.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually really good. Because it's like the child-friendly version of Devilman. So it's still super violent, but not quite as like grotesque.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. This book, I'm really glad Seven Seas is putting out more of these. I mean, besides this, they put out Lupin, the third book.
Yeah, it's a great one.
And then I think they're putting out a few more, but this is such an important part of manga history. It influenced so many other works afterwards. And while it might seem really weird to read it for the first time now, it really gives you great context for what came after.
Mm-hmm.
Deb, I just noticed you have like 100 bookmarks in your copy of Kamen Rider there, like on the top, like you've marked so many pages that you wanted to talk about. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, mostly I'm just like, I'm wowed up by like some of the double page spreads. Like some of them are just crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love it. It's like artistically, it's just a cool, like he doesn't necessarily do the kind of action storytelling I like the hardcore panel to panel. But when he does break a panel into moments or break a moment into several panels, it's always beautiful.
Yeah.
And the scarf is a killer like design element. It works on everything as far as I'm concerned.
Sometimes I feel like it's with Tezuka, right? This guy was so prolific and so busy working on so many series at once. He, like Tezuka, died at age 60, you know?
Mm.
He has a Guinness Book of World Records for the most comics published by one author, like 128,000 pages across 770 titles across 500 volumes. So he gets the King of Manga title, but, you know, at what cost, right? And I mean, not that, you know, that was what he was going for, but I sometimes wonder, like Tezuka, if he focused on one or two stories and just gave it his all, like Vinland Saga, that's his only series and he's giving it his all.
Yeah.
Current generations of manga creators have figured this out too, right? That it's more important to do good work and live long than just pump out lots of subpar work. Cause you know, everyone talks about multitasking, but no one can do it very well. And he's such a genius. I sometimes, you know, wonder like with Tezuka, like what would he have given the world if he just focused on one thing and did it exquisitely? or maybe he that was just not possible. Maybe he had like a ADHD or just too many things he wanted to do. Or I don't know what forces drove him to do that.
Did he have assistants on this work?
He did, yes.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, he had a whole company, like a whole
studio. Yeah.
I mean, one thing that comes up, we'll mention in the show notes, but Tokiwaso was a boarding house that Tezuka lived in. And several other legendary manga creators, including Ishinomura, came to live there. So they all lived together in this boarding house with no baths, just cold water sinks. They all lived in these little rooms. And we saw that room in the Furusato Museum reproduced.
We saw a model of it in the museum, the Ishinomura and the Mangatan as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was right by where I took a picture of David sitting next to Kamen Rider.
And they reproduced it. But it's just what the idea of this manga assistant thing came because these young, struggling manga creators all helped each other out.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got to make a deadline. Come spot my blacks. Oh, I got to do this background. You know, like these, many of them went on to become really famous manga creators, but it kind of created, it's been said that this is the roots of that system.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess that's kind of like how, was it Eisner and Iger sort of created the separation of labor in American comics?
Yeah.
Ah, right. That's interesting.
Yeah. A friend pointed out that the Bob Iger who runs Disney is related to the Iger from the Eisner times.
Really?
And it like really? Blew my mind. Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing. Huh. Let's go around the table and get some closing thoughts. So let's go backwards. Let's start with Chip.
Closing thoughts. I really enjoyed it as a piece of art. The kind of kinetic energy that the comics should have more of. And I have no idea who to recommend this to.
How about you, David?
Kamen Rider is awesome. It's really fun. It's very pure. If you like superheroes that are just superheroes, like no commentary or anything like that.
No keeping people alive.
Yeah. No moral codes, but still very political. Like he's like, you know, like maybe we should take care of the environment. Like it's a really fun comic from that angle. And like the constellation of stuff that is spawned from this is kind of impressive and imposing at the same time.
How about you, Chris?
I was just looking at the list, and this is the selected works of Ishinomori on the English Wikipedia page. And it's like, he maybe had, while he was doing Kamen Rider in 71 and 72, 8 serials that were going on at the same time, maybe more. Like, maybe not every month or every week, but definitely there are 8 titles. Actually, counting 72, maybe he started like 100 things right after Kamen Rider, the manga ended. Like maybe 20 different series he's got going at the same time. Sometimes one volume, sometimes two, sometimes 8. And it's just like, and he still turned this out. Like it's, and he and his production studio obviously still turned this out. It's just wild to me. It's just so wild that this is, that this exists at all. And then it ran for 4 volumes, which really speaks to how popular that show was. And then he created a thing that lasted for generations. It's kind of awesome to get to discover stuff like this, you know? Like, not discover Columbus. There you go. Columbus stuff like this. I'll put that link in the show notes as well. Very funny sketch about that. Yeah, I'm glad to have context for a visit that I really enjoyed with you guys to the museum with this work, because I was never a Power Rangers kid. So yeah, this is like, I don't know, man. I don't know that it landed well, but I mentioned Liefeld's work on the Devilman podcast. Someone who's just like wants to put lines down on paper and like get stuff out there and make shit look as cool as possible. And it's not always like for a pure reason, like, you know, putting a splash page, it's going to sell for 5 times as much as a page with 6 panels on it. But there's something about that. Like when you talk about really liking comics that have energy that like propel you through them, man, this is right there. And I think that's who I'd recommend this to, like people who actually really like the comics part of comics, even divorced from some of the content of comics. I think that there's a lot to look at here and to talk about here. Wonks and academics, basically. Nerds should read this.
Yeah.
You should read this. Deb, what was your final thought?
Well, I guess this is such a nice little trip down memory lane for me. And also something where I think, like Chip, I agree. It's hard for me to recommend this to a kid. It is very violent. But it is also, I think a kid would enjoy the action and the simplicity of it. I mostly appreciate it now from the craft point of view. I love how he's so inventive with how he handles his composition, how he draws action, and you see that he's always trying to find a new way to do something, and he's doing some things that I don't see contemporary artists doing. I see a creator who is just endlessly curious and willing to try something new, and I deeply admire that. I feel like, you know, in English manga publishing, we spent a lot of time getting all of Tezuka out there, and there is so much more to classic manga than Tezuka. I'm so glad we're getting Go Nagai, we're getting Ryoko Ikeda, Moto Hagio. I think Shotaro Ichinomori deserves at least as much respect as Tezuka, so I hope this is just the start of more work that we'll see from him in English.
Mm.
All right, that was Kamen Rider. I hope you enjoyed it. We will be back after this short little, hopefully lucrative, commercial break.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to another Manga Blind Date. This segment is brought to you by Viz Media, who sent us this book to check out. None of us have read it before, so we're just going into it blind. This time we're reading Record of Ragnarok, Volumes 1 and 2, written by Takumi Fukui, story by Shinya Uemura, and art by Azichika. It's a thing! It is. It's translated by Joe Yamazaki, touch-up and lettering by Mark McMurray, and edited by Mike Montessa. Basically, here's the introduction. The Valkyrie Brynhilde has convinced the gods to give humanity a chance at redemption through combat in the Valhalla arena. Seeking a quick end to the proceedings, the gods present their first fighter, Thor, the Norse god of thunder. Facing him is a warrior said to be the strongest in the history of mankind, the legendary general, Boom. Alrighty then. So, let's go around the table and let's hear what you thought of Record of Ragnarok, Volumes 1 and 2. How about Chris first?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. I was reading this. I started reading this. I'm like, wait, is this what I heard about on like the internet months and months ago? And it was, just like an epic battle manga where epic battles happen. and that was it. And it was, there's nothing else to it. And you're either on board with that or you're not. And I was on board. It is, man, you know, it's funny because I actually came around on Raw Hero when we read Raw Hero by the end, as starting out in a place and then ending up in a different place. The art looks very similar to that as well. And I was just in the right place for it. It is just like, it's just human grotesqueries fighting in the most insane ways that the mangaka, the writer, the script writer and the artist can think of. Just throwing themselves. It's like you've got action figures and you're just banging them together as hard as you can.
Oh my God, it's true.
That sums it up.
It's just awesome. Like if you want to see, and it's not even, oh man, how do I, it's not even like action figures. It's all customs. You know what I mean? Like it's not off the shelf action figures. Cause they're all like, we're just going to keep making this anatomy more ludicrous and the movements more ludicrous. Everyone's moving. Yeah. Like Bernie Horgarth is rolling over in his grave, looking at how these characters move in 3D space right now. Cause it's just like every joint is like quadruple jointed and like limbs are elastic. And it's just, man, you just want to see Lung Bu and like Thor swinging weapons at each other for like 250 consecutive pages, give her with some flashbacks thrown in. This is your book. You just want to see some people fighting, man. This is your book. You don't want to see people fighting. Well, this may not be for you. That's what I think about it.
Let's hear from Chip.
Well, as a pacifist, I just did not care for it.
Right.
It's not my thing. That was very evident very early on. Like, I enjoy books with violence and action, or else I wouldn't be making superhero comics. But that's just all this is. And like, there's a couple of jokes that I really liked, like saying that Adam, the original man who is one of the fighters, spoiler, that he's the original minimalist, and it just is a close up of the fig leaf. I did actually laugh out loud.
Great.
But this is a public service announcement. I'm begging all digital artists, please zoom out of the page. Like each of these panels is drawn almost by a different studio or something. Like, it's like the amount of detail in some of these tiny panels, and then you pull out and it's just like no details on a bigger panel. Like, nothing works together on a page. Individually, they're dynamic and interesting, but like the comic artist in me was just like, oh, please treat the page as its own thing.
You're saying you hate detail, then?
Love detail, but the detail has to have, there has to be a consistency throughout. That's all. Like, a lot of these tiny panels are just like jam. Like, they clearly zoomed in 1,000% and like drew the panel, then zoomed back out, then zoomed into another panel at 500% and drew it. It's intense. It's super intense.
Every crowd shot is just drawn. It's just like totally like as small as they could possibly, like maybe this guy's only 6 pixels, but damn it, all 6 pixels are there for every one of those guys. Like, it's just stadiums full of people and everyone's drawn. And then you get like a semi close up of like all the Chinese warriors, for example, and it just goes all the way through the panel. Like, it's so detailed. Like, if you like that, oh man, this is the book for you. Like, everything's drawn all the time. All the time.
Deb, what did you think?
This just felt like wrestling, like pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, it's just over the top goofy. And like, it's kind of like what we're talking about Las Vegas manga. It's just like, turn off your brain and just enjoy it for what it is. It's stupid. Mm-hmm. It's over the top. It's bloody and violent. It's so seinen manga. It's a capital S seinen manga. It's a man's manga. It's like like published by...
This is not a man's manga.
Oh,
don't you dare.
There is no female gaze in this at all. Come on.
I'm sorry, but Adam is not the hottest dude in this. Like, Adam is beautiful.
He is.
Every panel he's in, he is like just drawn immaculately. Like, he's so hot that one of the characters has to say, is he cute? Like he's sad about it or scared. Like, I've never thought men were cute before, but Adam, oh, like little heart emoji in the text. So yeah,
it is funny. I appreciate the humor here, though. It was fun.
Lungbu and Adam and even Shiva are all just drawn like...
Oh, Shiva's hot, yeah.
Slightly less grotesque than everybody else.
It is funny. You can tell they enjoyed making it. Like, even the revelation of the two pages of the combatants, like,
yeah.
I laugh at that point, too. Because, like, just above Adam in the order is Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And don't forget Nikola Tesla. I want to see that battle.
Tesla.
Right?
Yeah. Has there ever been a book that featured both Adam the First Man and Jack the Ripper and Tesla?
If there was, I'm sure Alan Moore wrote it.
It's true.
I will put in a little plug that I thought this was educational in a weird way.
Sure.
Because I still don't know much about the Three Kingdoms era. So, like, when it goes, and here comes Lu Bu, and I'm like, who's this? And then, you know, then they basically explain who this is and the history and blah, blah, blah. That stuff. Okay. And then you look at the rest of the human combatants. I think like a third of them are Japanese historical characters who like some of them I know, some of them I don't know. So it's like, well, if you're into mythology and you want a different take on mythology than what Neil Gaiman gives you, here you go.
They should probably teach this in schools. You're right.
I mean, it just kind of says that we don't learn much about Asian history or mythology, but you know. But I also give him credit for the fact that his or her Thor and Odin look nothing like the Marvel version. Even the hammer looks nothing like the Marvel version. Like, it's almost aggressively so.
Yeah.
But I avoided reading this book for a long time because all I could see was a picture of Aphrodite and that she has a tendons for each of her boobs to hold them up.
Yeah,
because they're like,
they are so big.
Because they literally are like the size of like I don't know, potbelly pigs, one each. Like she's holding two potbelly pigs, and anyway,
that is a visceral description, Deb. But in the interest of fairness, her attendants also fully nude, and honestly, her introduction, she is sitting on a dude, and his ass is like, I'm going to say a full third of that panel. Like, there's some equal opportunity. Like, this is like equal opportunity, not only in the sexiness, but in the grotesqueness. Like in book two on page 88, where Brunhilde turns around and yells at her little sister, she is gross, like terrifying, angry. And it's like, do you know how rare it is to have a manga that's willing to make a beautiful, you know, female character look ugly ever in any moment? Every female character, no matter how shonen or seinen battle manga it is always drawn beautiful. And to give her this facial expression that's on par with like the gross facial expressions that most of the dudes in this manga have is like, that's actually when I knew, I was like, oh shit, this is something different. This is something that's like, maybe there's more to this. And that's right before the Atom fight as well. And which is just like the whole Zeus entrance is ridiculous. You have to agree that like Hermes is playing like a song and then he has like Bach and Mozart both reacting to it. Like, this is what it sounds like when gods make music. Like, it's legitimately funny and they're doing weird dances. Like, it's so over the top.
Okay, so sorry. Like, I just want to sum up what both Chris and Deb are saying. This is an educational radical feminist tome that should be taught to everyone.
All right.
I think it's just truly equally offensive to everybody, or exactly what those people want to everybody. I wasn't quite sure, but I found a thread on the internet where it was talking about, yeah, basically like, yeah, I know this is kind of weird, but or kind of sus, but has everyone noticed like so many of the dudes in Record of Ragnarok are actually just really hot? And it was like, oh, I didn't. That was the, of all the takes I expected to hear about this particular book, that was not one of them. So yeah, it changed my opinion on this. I'm trying to decide whether or not I want to wait for the, we got to read the first two volumes. Do I want to wait for volume three, or do I just want to go watch the anime that's out now? And I think the anime might have me. So anyway, Record of Ragnarok. I did not expect to like it this much, and I totally had a fun time.
All right. I'm kind of guessing Kip isn't going to go for a third date with Record of Ragnarok.
I got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. I'm curious enough to see. I want to at least see what Tesla does. I'm just saying. I might not follow it to the end, but I just want to see how that one goes. All right. We were talking about Record of Ragnarok by Takumi Fukui, Shinya Uemura, and Azuchika. It's available now from Viz Media in print and digital. Go to bit.ly/Ragnarok podcast to read a free preview. And we're back. This week, I guess we'll just do a couple shout-outs and call it a day. So who wants to go first? David, maybe?
Yeah, let's do it. Since I nominated Chris earlier. my shout-out this week is to Lost in Space on Netflix. It's on its third and probably final season, knowing the way Netflix books TV shows. But it's kind of, it's a remake of an old thing, maybe the remake of even the 90s movie. But it does a good job of keeping like the adventurous Fantastic Four kind of vibe. Like, I don't think it's Fantastic Four done right, but it's definitely kind of mining like that same kind of emotional vein. And I don't know, it does a good job of like making the kids not annoying, which is really tough in some shows, I feel.
Yeah,
good no graphics, kidding. Good bad guys, decent banner. It's a little Whedon-y sometimes, but overall, it's a really fun show. And I'm glad I stuck with it through all the seasons.
Nice. My shout-out is Righteous Gemstones is back.
Yes.
And better than ever. And David, have you watched the first episode?
No, I'm doing it tomorrow.
Oh, I really... It's made for you and I. You'll know by the end of the episode what I mean by that. Yeah, I highly recommend it. Edie Patterson is probably the funniest person alive.
She's a very quiet MVP.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Is the first episode that good? Like, if I watch it, is it going to hook me? First episode? Or is it like it gets good?
Do you remember Tammy Faye Baker from the 80s?
Oh, God, yeah. I grew up in that. I hated her.
You'll love it.
Yeah.
Crying and talking about how the gays.
If you like, do you like Danny McBride stuff?
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that dialed down a little bit so other people can be dialed up a bit. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. It's good.
My shout out is actually, you guys reminded me of something when you were talking about comics to movie sort of translations and why people stay in comics. I just heard about this book by a guy who did a book. It was something the Wonder Dog. Starts with a D.
Duncan.
Yeah. Duncan the Wonder Dog. Yeah, that's it. That Ad House published. He had a new comic and it went on hiatus because it's called Generous Bosom. It's published by Breakdown, who are Breakdown Press. Sometimes manga publishers, Breakdown Press. It went on hiatus because it got picked up as a movie. So it's going to be like an art housey, you know, festival circuit kind of thing. The title of the movie is Ultrasound, which is a much more commercial title than Generous Bosom. But he actually just came back and released the fourth and final issue, and it's like a monster. And I just read a really interesting sort of review/interview thing on TCJ. I'll put the link in thing Sean McTiernan wrote, and it was just about the nature of how comics that sort of leave the comics space can suffer for it, especially when the author comes back to it because they've worked in this other medium and maybe what's special about comics is lost. And that is not the case in this one. It's like the most art comics-y, impenetrable comics ever. And also, since I'm shouting them out, they also did Ibisu Yoshikazu, who was extensively excerpted in one of the Frederick Schott books, either Dreamland Japan or Manga. They did The Pits of Hell by him. They did Fukushima Devilfish by Katsumata Susumu, which is also a really heavy book that is maybe not manga, maybe manga explaining one day. But they've got more manga on the way too. Yeah, Breakdown. They're doing some interesting stuff. I'll link their website and I'll link the review of Generous Bosom 4 because it's like, man, it did the exact job a review is supposed to, is to like make you curious about the book and want to check it out for yourself. So I feel like a visit to The Beguiling is in my future, maybe through their self-serve window to pick it up because I don't want to go into a store right now. Anyway, so that was my shout out. Deb, have you got a shout out?
I do, but it's something I guess I've mentioned a couple of times.
Let's do it.
I've got the latest volume of Blue Giant, which is the jazz manga. I love this so much. It just gets better and better. This is covers volume 7 and 8. The next volume covers 9 and 10, which will complete the whole series. It's nice. So wonderful. I mean, I actually made a little Spotify jazz list, grabbing all the songs that he mentions in the series in order.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so awesome. Cool. There's going to be an animated version of this story coming out this year. So I'm really looking forward to watching the story with music for a change.
Like how
they get the clearance?
Yeah, I was going to say, will they get the rights to the music for it? Or will it be like, kind of like...
It shouldn't be hard because they've actually done collaborations with Blue Note Records.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, they mention a lot of... I learned a lot about jazz by reading this. And it's like a grown-up shonen manga in that there's a scrappy guy who defies the odds to become a great jazz musician. And the way that he frames it by these flashbacks, it goes forward in time when these people remember this person later. It's so... I think it's really smart. And given how, well, let's just say it. The past couple of weeks have been kind of a downer. Blue Giant cheers me up immensely.
Nice.
Do you think it's a manga explaining book? Because I've always wanted to learn more about jazz. My knowledge is really not very strong there.
I would love for us to talk about Blue Giant because I think it's a different type of seinen manga compared to what we've, you know, done before, which is violence and sex and stuff. This is different. It is kind of slightly explainer manga-y, but I think it's just exquisite to see how he's expressing music in comics form.
Well, recommend it sometime. Maybe I'll pick it.
We will work on that. All right. This has been another Manga Explained episode. We're really glad you joined us. See you soon. There's more to come. This has been Manga Explaining episode 47. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be reading The Blood Red Boy by Minami Kyuta. Please consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. And also follow along with our reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment for this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.